Welcome to Indie Media On Air. And today we have some very special guests and a very interesting topic to discuss. We'll be joined by three guests to talk about anarchism. What is it? What does it mean? And how does it manifest itself within the global justice movement? Our first guest today will be David Graeber, who is an associate professor of anthropology at Yale University and is the author of a recent book called Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology. Our second guest is Evan, an activist organizer in the Indie Media Network and someone who has spent a great deal of time in South America helping to set up IMCs and get them off the ground. And our third guest is Ramsey, a founder and collective member of AK Press. I want to say a few things about the book first, which David Graeber will be with us to talk about. I got a copy of it from Chuck from Skylight Books, and it's one of those things that sort of gets spread around and people talk about, and it is a fascinating book, and it's for many reasons, and which we will discuss. But and I'm very happy to welcome David on the phone. David, are you with us?
Oh, yeah. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good. So anarchism is one of those subjects that brings to mind phrases like chaos and or the total breakdown of civilization, especially if you pay attention to the corporate press. In fact, of course, anarchy itself is constantly used as a synonym for chaos. And we know that the phrase anarchism implies something much more, something with a long intellectual history behind it. In fact, many well-known figures on what is loosely defined the left describe themselves as anarchists, including people like Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, and, in fact, the founder of Pacifica Radio himself, Lou Hill. So why don't we just start off with a really basic question. What is anarchism?
Well, anarchism comes from the Greek word for no rulers. It's basically a political philosophy that says that people can manage their own affairs and don't have to be, that structures of hierarchy and coercive force aren't necessary.
What would be an example of an anarchist organization?
Well, I always say that, like, you know, we operate with anarchist organizations all the time. Any group of people who come to common decisions without anybody forcing their will on anybody else is an anarchist organization. So anarchism is a broader political movement is just a way of saying that those are the only forms of organization that really have to exist. All the sort of coercive mechanisms of states are really unnecessary, and that a lot of this sort of behavior which makes people think it's necessary to have police, prisons, and armies and so forth is really a side effect of the existence of those structures themselves.
Well, you know, you ask a lot of very interesting questions in your book. Some you try to answer and others you leave open for others to answer. One question you discuss is why are there so few anarchists in academia?
Yeah.
And pointing out that anarchism is veritably exploding right now and inspired movements are growing everywhere. You say using traditional anarchist principles such as autonomy, voluntary association, self-organization, mutual aid, and direct democracy. So why isn't it studied in academy?
You know, that's a funny thing, and I've been wondering about that for years. Because, I mean, there are anarchists in the academy, and there's probably more than we know because a lot of people who are anarchists in the academy don't like to talk about it or won't say so unless they're actually asked. But just compared to academic Marxists, it's a remarkably small number. I think part of the reason is because whether or not you're an anarchist in the academy is kind of irrelevant, because anarchism is about practice. It's not an abstract theory. It's not an ideology in the sense of a theory of history. It's all about how you go about things. And since, well, I sometimes make the point that modern world, there's probably three institutions that have survived structurally more or less intact from the feudal age or the high middle ages. One of them is the Roman Catholic Church, the other is the British monarchy, and the third is the university system. And it's a completely feudal structure. So to act like an anarchist within it, you almost necessarily get in trouble.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. What else? What are the other examples of that?
Well, I mean, you want to know about anarchists in the academy and what they're doing? I mean, I think there are groups of people who are doing all sorts of things. I think that in the academy, as long as what you do is outside of the power structures of the university itself, people believe that you should be able to say or think whatever you like. It's just when it comes to democratizing the university, you start to get in trouble. For example, if you support labor organizing on campus or something like that. But, I mean, there are a lot of people doing it.
Well, okay, let's just talk about what are fragments of an anarchist anthropology. Why is anthropology relevant here?
Oh, well, I've actually been criticized by that, just by trying to preserve traditional academic boundaries like sociology versus anthropology and so forth. And I don't really. I just think of anthropology as being the only discipline that really takes into account all human beings. Traditionally, most people on Earth have been relegated to this sort of other category of, if you want to listen to the history of music, you learn all about a certain tradition of Western music and everything else gets shoved into anthropology. Want to learn about a certain tradition of politics, any tradition of politics other than one very particular tradition of politics, it all gets shoved into anthropology as well. So almost all the real history of human possibilities and alternatives has been kind of separated off and shoved into anthropology. So if you want to learn anything about the full range of political, social, economic possibilities, that's where you have to go. The other nice thing about anthropology is that it's always been a discipline which believed not in studying things from a distance, but actually participating. If you want to understand a ritual, you actually take part in it. You go live in a village somewhere. You try to become as much as possible a part of the community that you're in, and you actually talk to people. So it's very hands-on.
Well, there's probably many examples of societies that you've studied that have these sort of elements that we described earlier, these principles. Maybe you can give a few examples.
Well, I mean, I first became interested in this. It's interesting that I grew up, and I always had a little bit of an ambivalent attitude toward anarchism because my dad actually fought in the Spanish Civil War. And he was of the International Brigades, who, of course, were brought in by the Stalinists, and they were very much propagandized against the anarchists. But my dad, he was an ambulance driver, and his sanitario was a anarchist, and they got along great. And he actually really fought a lot of the anarchists that he knew and thought it was terrible that the revolution in Spain effectively was suppressed. But he always felt that, from a strictly military point of view, he would always say it was silly. You have to have a modern army to fight a modern army. And I think a lot of people of his generation felt that way. So I always, thought of anarchism as an interesting thing, but perhaps a little impractical, until I actually started learning anthropology. And where I ended up doing my field work was Madagascar. And Madagascar, at the time I was there, between 1989, 1990, 1991, was in an interesting place because in a lot of the countryside, the state had effectively disappeared. So people were de facto living without, in an anarchist society. There was no centralized state. There's a police station actually in town, but they wouldn't leave the paved road, which was just one little highway. So pretty much where everybody lived, the police would not come. Nobody was paying taxes. People had essentially found autonomy from the state, but they were all kind of pretending they hadn't so that no one would notice. So, in effect, I actually lived in an anarchist society for almost a year.
And so when you say that, when you say there's no state, you're saying that sort of the taxation, the police, the prisons, mm-hmm. sort of the fundamental organization of society was radically different. So mm-hmm. so how did people make decisions? How did the problems get solved? How did the difficulties with sewage or whatever the issues were, how did they get resolved?
Well, there's a traditional way of doing these things in most such societies, which is almost always turns out to be some form of consensus decision-making. And I know there's a lot of debate about, consensus decision-making. Is it good? Is it oppressive? But if you don't have any centralized means of coercion, that's pretty much what you got to fall back on. You got to come back to some system where people sit down together and come up with something that at least nobody strongly objects to. Or even those who do object to it agree, feel that they've consented to it rather against their better judgment rather than having it forced down their throats. So in Madagascar, there was a thing called the Fukunum, which really is just a way of saying everybody, but it's everybody concerned of a given problem meets and discusses it. And this is the way people had been doing things for thousands of years. So when centralized authority vanished, in a lot of ways, not much changed.
Well, okay, so What other societies can we talk about, can we look at, and possibly learn from this kind of collective decision-making?
Oh, I mean, I think all over the world. When people, in effect, what we call democracy, it seems to me, really derives from people trying to apply those kind of decision-making structures where people have always done things together on a level of the state. And, of course, there's a kind of contradiction because real collective decision-making is done without coercion. And when people don't have the power to coerce one another, they figure out ways to come to agreement with one another. Now, it's only when people try to get that same egalitarian spirit and then apply it on a level which is the states, which are ultimately based on having the power to force minorities to go along with majorities, that the thing becomes confused. I think you can go pretty much anywhere in the world, even places that seem like their traditions are very anti-democratic, like China, and you look at how things are done on a local level, it's very much like what anarchists would talk about, grassroots democracy.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I mean, I think the next obvious question is, well, for an advanced technological society, why is this relevant?
Well, I don't know why technology really changes very much in this way.
Or I should say industrial. And, you know, how is it in a modern industrial society with millions of people around the world? How are these ideas going to apply?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I think that a lot of things are already, as I say, done through essentially voluntaristic, anarchistic ways. I mean, people always give examples like the postal service. There's no central authority in the world postal system. You have 130 different nations now, all figuring out how to coordinate these things without any one of them having the power to force the others. So a lot of structures actually do operate on a consensual basis already. So what we're really talking about is expanding the range at which things are done on a voluntary level.
Okay, you write that Marxism has tended to be a theoretical or analytical discourse about revolutionary strategy, whereas anarchism has tended to be an ethical discourse about revolutionary practice.
Yeah, I do.
What is this ethical discourse?
Well, I'm just talking about comparing the history, because in a way people always are trying to cast anarchism as something like Marxism as a theory, and then of course it's always found wanting in some way or another. But really, it's kind of like comparing apples and oranges. I mean, one could actually be a Marxist anarchist, I suppose a lot of people have. Because they're talking about different things. I once remember hearing someone said, if you want to really understand people, don't listen to what they say, listen to what they talk about. And anarchists tend to talk very specifically about questions, ethical questions about what to do. So if you look at the history of debates within anarchism, the kind of thing that people tend to be arguing about are very different than the sort of thing that Marxists tend to be arguing about. You know, nobody's talking about the nature of the commodity form and sort of excommunicating themselves or disagreeing on whether the peasants are a revolutionary class. You know, anarchists tend to think that's something for peasants to decide. Instead, there are questions like, well, you know, if somebody assassinates a head of state, do you have to, you know, should you condemn them for killing somebody? These people shouldn't kill people, or should you express solidarity? You know, how should you feel about this? If somebody breaks a window and it wasn't in the terms of agreement for the protest, should you get mad at them, or should you express solidarity? What's the best way to run a meeting? What's really democratic? At what point does organization become stifling and oppressive, and at what point is it enabling? They're all very practical questions about the morality of actual action. Yeah.
Right.
And those are the very things that a lot of Marxist groups tend not to talk about, and which is one of the things which allows them to become so authoritarian.
Well, Marx, after all, was an analyst, you know, specifically of capitalism.
Yes, he was.
And a lot of people have taken his ideas and then turned it into a movement, which you actually say was started by one of the few movements that was started by a PhD.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm sure there must be others, but I can't think of any offhand.
Right. Well, I mean, that opens the question of what is the difference between authoritarianism and non-authoritarianism, and my understanding is you have a sort of a broad spectrum called socialism. And on the left, you have the anti-authoritarians, and on the right, you have the authoritarians. Would you describe that as accurate?
Yeah. Sometimes anarchism has been referred to as libertarian socialism or libertarian communism. That was an old word for it until the right wing stole the word libertarian away. It tends to be the most freedom-oriented on people on the left.
Right. Chomsky uses that phrase.
Yeah. Yeah, it used to be very popular in the turn of the century. But then I guess, like, the left stole the word liberal from the right, so the right stole the word libertarian back from the left again.
One of the parts of your book I really enjoyed was you had this debate between the anarchist and the skeptic.
Oh, yeah.
And the skeptic says, and I'm just going to read the first part and then finish up, says, well, you know, I might take this whole anarchism idea more seriously if you could give me some reason to think it would work. Can you name me a single viable example of a society which existed without a government? And then you go on to talk about a few examples, and then, you know, the skeptic accuses your examples of being primitives, and then you say, well, okay, you know, we can talk about Mondragon, we can talk about Linux, even the software system, mm-hmm. about, you know, sort of a voluntary association of programmers, and they use, something based on consensus and direct democracy. And then the skeptic says, sure, but these are all small, isolated examples. You know, we're talking about societies. And then, you know, the anarchist says, well, what about the Paris Commune or the Spanish Revolution? And I might add the Argentinian revolt in which workers have taken over the factories. And then the skeptic says, yeah, well, look what happened to those guys. They all got killed. And so on and on you go.
I actually had this conversation frequently. That's why I wrote it down.
But it is true. And, I mean, the conversation happening all the time. So, then you break down this concept of, or I should say, you differentiate between society and nation state.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, because I think that's really true, that we have a tendency to imagine the state as being somehow so natural that it's hard to think outside it. So you think of a society, it's like this little bounded unit and everybody's sort of the same and they're under a similar code of laws or something like laws, speak a common language. And it's the ideal of the nation state, and you just sort of assume that before there was a state, these things existed. Well, they didn't. In most of history, most people were, well, it depends on what part of the world, but you take, I don't know, East Africa, a place I'm fairly familiar with. Most people probably spoke three or four different languages. They were part of different types of associations. They might have been part of some political unit, but on the other hand, they were also part of some, craft guild that spanned five or six different language-speaking areas or different political units. They might have been involved in some exchange systems. They might have been involved in kinship groups, which just cross-cut each other in a million different ways. So, like, where one society starts, another stops. You can't tell. And I think that's much more sort of ordinary way for people to live than in little homogenous units like we tend to imagine. And that's what an anarchist society would be like, too, I'm sure. It'd be these very complicated cross-cutting networks. Now, so when you say, show me an anarchist society, it doesn't make any sense because, I mean, some of those networks are already free and we just want to make them all that way.
And exactly, you use the examples of endless associations, networks, projects at every conceivable scale, and even some that we can't imagine.
Yeah. I think that we have no idea. I mean, a lot of the things we're involved with right now, we probably couldn't have imagined 30 years ago.
Okay, it brings me to my next question, which is this concept of anarchists not actually trying to seize power within any national territory, and actually moving beyond this understanding of a revolutionary cataclysm, mm-hmm. such as storming the Bastille or seizing the Winter Palace,
yeah,
right. But you're talking about a different way of thinking about change itself.
Yeah, and it's like a similar thing to what I was saying about societies in a way. It's like saying the same thing for time as instead of space. We try to think in these tiny bounded units. So just like we like to think here's a society, it has borders like nation state does, is it anarchist or not? You know, we think the same thing about history, like, the equivalent of a border is a revolution. Suddenly everything changes, you're in a different stage of history. And that's not really how it's ever worked before, or how it's likely to work. I mean, there's constant opening up of new spaces. There's a constant accretion. And I think, in a way, that's part of the pitfall of at least most very conventional Marxism, is that they just assume that there would be some kind of fundamental break. It's a big argument between anarchists and Marxists, actually, was the Marxists said, well, you know, there are people who are already practicing autonomy, practicing democracy. They can provide a model. We can slowly build a new society in the shell of the old. And Marx would have none of this, actually. He said, this is ridiculous. They're just petty bourgeois. Their critiques or moralistic critiques are just based on this petty bourgeois morality. We're talking about a whole new stage of history where everything will be fundamentally and totally different, an absolute negation of what exists now. We cannot even possibly imagine what a new society would be like, so therefore let's not try. It seems to me that's really what made it possible for a lot of the terrible things that happened in the name of Marxism. You know, I don't want to put down all Marxists equally, certainly. But, you know, most
Marxists, for example, being, like, you know, give us an example of that.
Well, I mean, I always say that this condemnation of petty bourgeois morality that Marx had was the sort of thing which could easily lead to, like, what the Bolshevik revolutionaries would talk about, bourgeois sentimentality, which is the phrase they used for people who objected on principle to, say, like, murdering people in cold blood, to set an example.
You're referring to Stalin and Mao.
Leninists were already doing it. Yeah, Stalinists did it a lot.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, once you say that, like, the moral rules of the old world just do not apply at all, everything will be totally different, you know, you're opening the door to almost anything.
Sort of a justification of anything that happens.
Pretty much. Yeah.
You talk about, well, you know, the easiest way to get our minds around it is to stop thinking about revolution as a thing, or mm-hmm. you say the revolution, the great cataclysmic break, and instead mm-hmm. ask, what is revolutionary action?
Yeah. I think that's actually a really useful tool of thought that applies to almost anything. You know, objects, in a certain way, are illusions. What we have are processes and actions. So, I mean, the same thing happens, like, what is politics? You know, what is the political sphere? Don't think that. Think, what is political action? You know, don't think, what is the revolution? Think, what is revolutionary action? It makes it much easier to understand what's really going on.
Right. Well, that brings me to another question, and that is, you know, what about the ongoing era of anarchist-inspired organizing, as you describe, from mm-hmm. Chiapas to Seattle to Argentina? What is it in those inspired organizations that are relevant to this project of, as you say, revolutionary action?
Well, I think just about everything. I think that, in a way, what they involve is reconnecting with the wellsprings of popular creativity which have always existed and which, for various reasons, revolutionaries had tended to... There's a certain kind of revolutionary elitism that people would fall into, especially when revolutionaries think that, you know, they have the real theory. They have the analysis, which is the direction which history must take. You stop listening to people. And I think what's really powerful and new about anarchist movements is it's all about listening to people and realizing that the people that, you know, you used to think of yourself as a vanguard trying to liberate might understand a lot more than you do. So it's trying, you know, it's a form of real solidarity. I remember talking to a friend of mine in Belgrade who was organizing a PGA conference in Serbia who was visiting these various factories occupied by their workers, and he said that in several cases people just started crying because he was, when we came and said, well, we just want to listen to what you're doing and see how we can help you, because nobody had ever said that to them before. Everybody else showed up and started telling them the real analysis of their situation and what they had to do. The idea of revolutionaries coming and actually just asking them what they needed and what they wanted and what there was to learn from what their own struggles was something that they'd never experienced. It's pretty amazing if you think about it.
Yeah, and in fact, the Zapatista example, I think that's really important. Not only in your book do you talk about anthropologists turning their back on what happened down there,
mm-hmm.
but you talk about the importance of what they had to teach people. And I think people who were involved or familiar with the solidarity groups and what the Zapatistas were saying very much took that to heart. The Zapatistas taught so many people, so many things, and it's not surprising that when you hear people talk about Seattle, the place they point to is down south. Well, obviously, and the Zapatistas having a big part of that.
I think it's one of the things that's so wonderful about this movement is that it's pretty much the first global movement I can think of where the ideas are mostly flowing from south to north. I mean, most of the really sort of signature elements, everything from affinity group structures, direct democracy, consensus, mass nonviolent direct action, for that matter, I mean, it really comes out of South Africa and India. Almost all the ideas are flowing south to north now, which is a wonderful thing because, you know, most people do live in the south. That's where most of the new creative ideas should be coming from.
I want to remind our listeners that we are speaking with David Graeber, an author of Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, associate professor of anthropology at Yale. And we're going to be having two more guests, so I want to remind listeners to stay tuned. But, David, I want to ask a final question. One of the things that seems to be sitting in the room, sort of the big elephant, if you will, is let's imagine you have all these associations, these networks, these organizations that start to work together globally, very much the way Indie Media does and many other organizations. You still have this issue of massive state violence, massive state power that can pretty much crush anything that it really focuses. Well, the argument is made that it can just devastate and destroy these organizations. What's your response to that?
Well, it's a tough one. I mean, one thing I always remind people in this country is that if the state really wanted you dead, they could arrange it very easily. If the U.S. government decided they wanted everybody in the globalization movement eliminated, you know, organizing death squads and just killing us all would be the easiest thing. I mean, that's the kind of thing they're actually very good at, states. And one of the interesting things, actually, I've always observed in direct action is that it's always the state that wants things to turn violent. I mean, just pure violence. Because pure violence, they're pretty good at it. I mean, they have it down. They've been studying it for years. They have a lot of experience. It's when you try to mess things up and scramble the categories that they get confused.
That's a really, really good point, because I think people who are involved in a lot of these massive events around the global justice movement have seen firsthand that it's always the police who start the violence.
Yeah.
Because they change the terms on which you have to interact.
Exactly, and they change the terms to ones which they know, are familiar with, and have studied every angle on how to act in. But, you know, how to deal with, like, a bunch of clowns and puppets and musicians sort of trying to change the entire terms of engagement becomes very, very difficult. And they often, you know, have no idea what to do. And I think that, I mean, the way I sometimes put it, there's two different types of political ontology, if I to be technical. You know, there's a politics which emerges from violence and assumes that violence is the ultimate reality, and there's a politics which emerges from the imagination. And, you know, both lead in very different ways. And I think that states rely on the assumption that the ultimate reality is violence. But violence is ultimately doesn't create anything. I mean, structures of violence have to rely on human creativity and imagination, sort of colonizing it and controlling it. And any rebellion against it has to root itself not in violence, but in the imagination. I mean, no doubt violence will... I'm not saying anybody uses violence as a bad person, right? But very often, I mean, if you look at the Zapatistas, I think they're a beautiful example. What they did was they used exactly as much violence as they needed in order to be able to put themselves in a position where they didn't have to use violence anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
David, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Indie Media on Air, and it was really a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It was really fun to talk to you, too.
I want to remind our listeners that was David Graeber, who wrote a book called Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, associate professor at Yale in anthropology. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back, and we'll be speaking to Evan, activist organizer in the Indie Media Network, and then shortly joined after that with Ramsey from the AK Press Collective. And you are listening to KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and live on the web at www.kpfk.org. All right, welcome back to Indie Media On Air. This is Chris Burnett, and I was speaking with David Graeber. And now we're going to move on to another topic, similar in scope, with Evan from the Indie Media Network, an activist organizer in the network. Evan, are you with us?
Yeah, I am.
Hey.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. I assume that you got to hear the first half of the show.
Yep.
And some of the subjects we were talking about. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on today is because you spent quite a bit of time in South America and perhaps Central America too, organizing IMCs down there.
Yeah, I've been sort of intimately involved with organizing the Indie Media Network as it's grown over the last over 4 years. And as a result, I've been sort of both working with and aware of social movements which have employed some of the anarchist ideas, but also expanding the Indie Media Network, which is itself an example of an anarchist organization.
Well, let's talk about that. How is it an example?
Indie Media differs from many organizations because there was principles at the base of it which said that it will be based on democracy and consensus and individual participation, giving people value to participate in the decisions, and that there'd be no presidency, there'd be no executive council or head office. Each local indie media center is an equal center in participating in the decisions of the network, and there's a tremendous amount of autonomy so that, you know, the people in Seattle, where the Indie Media Network started, have the same value, the same ability to make decisions as the people in Palestine or Bolivia.
So let's talk about some of the places you went to and maybe some of the stories that you have from being there and working with people.
Sure. The most interesting places where people are using indie media has to be the folks working in Argentina, where they've been creating media tools, communication tools, with these occupied factories. To understand the history of Argentina is a relatively developed country that went through a tremendous amount of neoliberal reforms in which everything that could possibly be privatized was, much more than the United States. And this led to a very serious crisis, which culminated in an economic collapse in 2002. Many of the factories that had existed in the country were shut down because the owners couldn't pay their debts. And
pay their debts to who?
Pay their debts to people who'd invested in them, pay their debts to taxes to the state, pay their debts to their creditors, all sorts of people. They just stopped being able to make money. So the first thing they stopped doing was paying workers. And they kept on running the factory until everything else collapsed, and these workers had been working in these factories, producing goods, often with months or a year of not receiving any salary. And eventually, in many cases, over 200 cases, the workers sort of rebelled, and they took the factories and they said, okay, you know, you're not paying us, you're not paying your creditors, we're going to retake this factory and run it without the bosses, run it without the owners. And that's what they did in a number of large factories. And of course, the Argentine state was not too happy about this, and they've had a number of years of struggle to maintain these factories as independent cooperatives.
I know, I find the story fascinating. I mean, it's an example of people really turning upside down the notion that you need to have capital owners, investors, managers to run these factories. And from what I understand, these factories were running by worker decision.
Yep.
And I should mention that there's a film with by Naomi Klein and another filmmaker, and I'm really sorry I forget his name.
Absolutely.
Called The Take.
Yep.
And there's also a website called workerswithoutbosses.net. Abby Lewis.
Yes.
Abby Lewis. So that the story is fascinating. You've been to these factories, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Talk about them, please.
Each factory is different. I mean, each factory produces different things. The makeup of the workers are there. So they always come with a different model for how to run the factory and what they're trying to achieve. The most famous of the factories is this factory in southern Argentina called the Zanon factory. And it's the second largest ceramics factory in Latin America. And the owner of this factory, even though he'd received tremendous amounts of corporate welfare from the Argentine state, had managed to run the factory into the ground. And he shut it down and fired all the workers. And they came back in, and they started rerunning it. And they reopened this factory and started producing ceramics. They produced them at sort of lower cost, more of the money distributed to the workers, a better run factory than had ever been run before by the previous owner.
Really?
Yes.
And what were you doing there?
I was working with Indie Media to build a network of helping people communicate. Now, I didn't work specifically in the Zanon factory, but what the Indie Media activists in Argentina did was say, okay, you guys are here controlling what you're doing your work, you need to get your message out to the world. And so the Indie Media activists in Argentina went down and they set up a computer and they set up an internet connection so that the workers inside the factory can produce their own media, they can send out their own media releases, their own information to the rest of the world and all the other people in other occupied factories. And through this, they've built a rather substantial network of occupied factories so that they can build an economic system where you're not going from one occupied factory selling to a normal capitalist business, but actually having commerce between this network of several hundred occupied factories.
And how is that working? Are they surviving?
They're surviving in different ways. Some of them are surviving well. Some of them have converted into being retaken. So they're through the police being brought in, the owners of the factory says, well, no, now you made it work again economically, I'm going to retake it. So some of them have been since lost, but most of them are continuing to run as profitable cooperatives that are run without bosses.
Okay, I think we're going to bring Ramsey in from AK Press in a minute and continue the discussion. I want to bring this back to the original discussion of anarchist principles.
Yep.
Autonomy, voluntary association, self-organization, mutual aid, and direct democracy. Do these people, you know, they're obviously acting in this way, and I think we heard from the previous interview that it's really about what people do, not so much as what they say. Maybe talk a little bit about that in this sort of the relationship between these factories and the sort of body of knowledge that we were discussing earlier.
That's really interesting because in Argentina, that for the last 70 years, there hasn't been a substantial body of people organizing under the banner of anarchism. There's been a number of various Marxist groups that have tried to organize for radical social change. And these occupied factories didn't come out of those groups. These occupied factories came out of workers getting together and saying, well, here we are, we're stuck in a situation where we have no jobs, we have a factory, we know how to work it, we know how to run it. How can we say, okay, how can we come up with something that works? And because they've either run the bosses off or they've left them, people have said, well, okay, how do we have to organize it? You know, we're all the same here. We're all going to come up with a model. And the models, sort of anarchist or autonomous models that have come up from the bottom of people just getting together and saying, well, what's the best way for us to organize this workplace for ourselves?
Right. I want to give out the phone number because we're going to open the phone shortly.
Yep.
818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. And we're going to be joined with Ramsey in just a minute. Is Ramsey on the line? Okay. That's really interesting, Evan. So it didn't come from an ideological position. It didn't come from some abstract body of knowledge, but it came directly from their own direct needs to do something about the situation, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, they worked with other traditional leftist groups and built networks and collaboration. But the real core of it, the definition of how people organize, came from their direct needs and not some academic ideological background.
Right. So, Evan, I'd like to ask you to stay on the phone, and I bring Ramsey into the discussion. Ramsey?
Hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Welcome. Ramsey is a member of AK Press Collective, and somebody who has a lot of knowledge, probably having read a lot of books that they distribute. Ramsey, over the last 20 years or 10 or 15 years, given the discussion we've been having, can you sort of map out what has happened, maybe in broader theoretical terms, and maybe where we're going, and what's your experience?
My experience has probably been twofold and relates a lot to what your two previous guests were saying. I think, firstly, or to backtrack slightly, I think the anarchist ideology, shall we say, or anarchist theory, has been both a blessing and a curse, not just over the last 15 or 20 years, but perhaps over the last 100 years. And that was anarchism, unlike Marxism, as I believe, David, your first guest was saying. Anarchism didn't come out of someone thinking it would perhaps might be a good idea to organize life in a certain way. But anarchism, both as a theory and a practice, kind of came out of the, for want of a better term, the organic struggle of people struggling to control their own lives and the systems of power, domination, hierarchy that they find themselves suffering under. And I think that has been very much the strength of anarchism. And that is why,
let's talk about the weaknesses, the sort of problems.
I think that the problems, I think, also stem from a similar thing. Again, David was talking about perhaps anarchism hasn't been strong in academia, in the academy. I don't think that being strong in the academy is necessarily a good thing, but I think part of this, if you like, the genesis of anarchist theory coming from a practice, and in very many ways a heroic and hard-fought practice, has meant that it's been very soft on theory and analyzing the world. I think what the Marxists have been very good at and have made many great contributions, I think, is analyzing, is both positing a theoretical framework from which to analyze the world, however flawed, and I think the framework is in many ways very flawed, but they're providing a framework, if you like, a prism from which you can look at society, economics, politics, culture, the arts, and try and put analysis on that. And anarchism has been not so good at that. So again, and through AK Press and both the literature that we publish and distribute, anarchists have been very successful in being involved in much of these movements in very wonderful ways. They haven't been so good, if at all, at analyzing the strengths, the weaknesses, what we can learn from that, where we might go from here, and perhaps what is causing these movements.
Do you see that changing?
I think there are some glimmers of hope. I think there is a group largely based in the Northeast called the Institute for Anarchist Studies, and they do a variety of good work, including they provide grants and funding to people writing about anarchism or about subjects through an anarchist prism or perspective. They also host an annual conference called Renewing the Anarchist Tradition, which again focuses on as much, if you like, that theoretical and philosophical underpinnings of anarchism as much as the activism and the nuts and bolts of the practice, shall we say.
Our producer, Alan, says that the anarchists keep winning the soccer matches between the communists and the Bay Area.
That is also correct. I mean, I think that is a wonderful example of the triumph of an excellent theory and practice put together, personally.
Evan, did you have something to say?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So the next question is, and I think it's an important one, why would your average person who, you know, has to worry about struggling just to pay rent, is thinking about the voting system in the United States, Kerry Bush scenario, why would any of these ideas be relevant to their lives? And either one of you can answer that question.
I think that, if I may jump in first, I mean, I think those ideas are not just relevant to people's lives, they are the very essence, they're the stuff of people's lives. For me, the strength of anarchism, it is both a theory and practice for people controlling their own lives in whatever sphere, as much the cultural or the economic, as much as, if you like, the political and the straight, Kerry Bush voting dichotomy. And as I said before, I think the reason that people turn to anarchist practice, and if you like, the theory behind that, not intuitively, but because it seems to be the best way of doing it, is largely because those ideas and methods of organization are common sense. I think it's been the failure, if you like, of anarchist theory, and certainly anarchist propaganda, to make those connections.
Well,
we're not talking about some bizarre theory, we're not talking about some impractical, almost otherworldly, wouldn't it be nice if, that these are things that people can and do all the time.
And as we have learned in the last hour, just with the many examples that Evan was talking about, where in the workers in Argentina, the voluntary associations like Indie Media, etc. I mean, they're ubiquitous.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, you're still stuck with this sort of image problem. You know, young white punk kids or lifestyle oriented or what have you. And certainly, there have been a huge effort to demonize these ideas. You know, where do you begin to break out of that?
If I could take this one, I mean, I think one of the ways, the solutions for people when they talk about the image problem of anarchists is you look at people's organizing through their practice. I mean, you start out with saying, this is how we work, these are how we make decisions, this is how we organize our network, and you say... And when people ask, well, where did you learn that? What's the context behind it? You say, well, this is anarchist practice. You know, that's a lot of what's been successful in terms of spreading the indie media ideas around the world. We didn't go out and say, this is an anarchist organization. We went out and said, this is how we organize. This is how we work. This is how we plan to change the world. And when people ask to follow up, well, where did you get these ideas? What's the context? Where do I learn more? We say, well, this is look at the anarchist history and the anarchist tradition.
Okay, we have a caller on line one, but before we go to that, I want to get off the phone number again, which is 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. Charles, on line one. Charles, are you there?
Yeah. Hey, how you doing, Chris?
Good.
This is Charles from the Skylight Bookstore.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. I'm glad to hear you doing this. I was on my way into the work today, and everybody's screaming that you're going to be interviewing David Graeber on the radio. So I listened to that. We've actually been listening to it here at the bookstore. And I just wanted to call and say hi to Ramsey up at AK, who I get to talk to about once a year.
Hey, Charles.
And I wanted to thank David Graeber for his great work and for you guys having him on the air. I appreciate you doing that. It's makes things a little bit more vindicating for me. I've been trying to hand these kind of books to people for the last 12, 13 years, and to see some real evidence like this of this information getting out to the people through you. Makes me feel a little bit better about what I'm doing. So I just wanted to call and thank you guys for doing this.
Great. Do you have any questions?
Not really. I'm just listening to what you guys are saying. I mean, okay. I think everything Ramsey's had to say is very eloquent, and David Graeber obviously very eloquent. And it's nice to actually have a forum now through Indie Media and through KPFK where this kind of sophisticated discussion can be done so that we can get past the kind of cliches that Graeber points out in his book about all the stupid questions that people like you and Ramsey have to put up with all the time from people who, unfortunately, have not been exposed to these ideas and how actually practical they are.
Great, Charles. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Keep up the good work.
Okay, the next caller is Paul. Welcome to KPFK, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
All right. I just, like the last caller, would like to extend my appreciation for you guys taking the time, because I know it's not a very profitable job there working at KPFK and doing what you do, but you're willing to set forth these ideas and try and change people's minds. Unfortunately, the people whose minds need to be changed the most probably don't listen. They get most of their information from mass media sources and CNN and places like that. Are you there?
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I'm in an area where I'm not sure if I was going to lose you on my phone or not.
Do you have any questions?
Yeah, the question I have is, how do you combat the stigmatism that's been attached with an anarchist type of mind? I mean, it's a mindset that is, to me, so fundamentally correct and just obviously right, and the way that things need to be done. I mean, there's the only way in the world that we live in to truly govern ourselves is through anarchy. I mean, that's the only way. And people think of it, you say anarchy to the layman, and they think of chaos. I mean, how do you combat that?
Well, that's, yeah, exactly. I pointed out at the beginning it's a synonym for chaos in the mainstream press. Evan or Ramsey, do you want to address this?
Sure. I mean, I think there's if I had an easy, painless answer, then, of course, anarchism would have triumphed and we'd all be living in peace and harmony 100 years ago. It's not that easy. But I think, as I've said and folks have pointed out before, I think those folks that watch Fox News or that are considering voting for Bush or Kerry, nevertheless, in many aspects of their everyday life, are acting in anarchist ways. They practice mutual aid, they help their neighbors, they band together with their neighbors or workmates or friends to do all kinds of things which are anarchist practices and are just as much an anarchist practice as the internal functionings of AK Press or of indie media. I think the challenge, and it is a challenge, but it's not an insuperable problem since they're doing it anyway, is to, if you like, gently point out to such folks that anarchism isn't this impossible pie in the sky, wouldn't it be nice if, but actually the seeds and the structure in many ways are already there.
Right.
The problem is getting rid of those pesky things like the state, which are unfortunately stopping people realizing their full potential.
Perhaps we need to get one of those fancy lobbying groups, and we can change the name of we have a different connotation for the word.
Totally correct.
Well, okay. Thanks for your question. I'm gonna.
I have another comment. Can I make a comment?
Sure, quickly.
Okay. It just seems to me funny. I just realized that almost like the Amish seem to be so extreme right and conservative and so fundamentally Christian and religious, and now it seems as though they're so far left. It's funny, you know. It's almost like they're anarchists in their own way.
Yeah, that's the next show.
all right. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. All right, Tiffany, welcome to KPFK. Do you have a question?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I am actually just, you know, a student, a community college student, and a housewife. And, you know, I've been inspired actually by historical examples of, like, Emma Goldman and recently of actually, like, the new types of science studies that are coming out about chaos and chaos theory. And... I was just wondering, you know, how do I talk to my relatives about this kind of stuff, like, you know, around, like, the Thanksgiving table, you know? I mean, I have a hard time relating with them and expressing my my views, I guess.
That is a fantastic question. And I want to just real quickly say that I think it's about what you do in your life and how we organize that give the examples of how we work together. And I mean, Ramsey or Evan, can you address that?
I think another issue, especially when you're talking to people who aren't sort of steeped in radical politics, is to drop the rhetoric. Talk about values. Talk about how we want to organize our families, our lives,
uh-huh.
What kind of ideal world we want. And then you can relate to people. But in some ways, the ideological scaffolding that anarchists and especially Marxists can create artificial distance. I mean, you talk about, you know, if you're debating whether or not that's petite bourgeois, then people can't relate. But if you're talking about, you know, what it's like when you interact with your boss and why he's an asshole because he feels like he has all this power, that's
right.
How people can connect.
Right.
Okay.
Or I think to just give an even more mundane example, perhaps. My guess is that the way your parents raised you, that much of that upbringing was to do with childcare. I'm guessing also, since it's
uh-huh.
really typical, that childcare involved you going to different forms of babysitting, perhaps group childcare, perhaps your parents clubbed together with other parents in the area and arranged that kind of childcare.
Right.
To me, that is a great example of mutual aid. No one is profiting from that. Everyone is benefiting from that. And that's a classic example of, if you like, anarchist community activity.
Right.
It's not called that. But
exactly.
I don't see any other name for it.
Exactly. It's kind of like, correct me if I'm wrong, I've heard anarchists talk about ridding ourselves of the ism and kind of like liberating ourselves from all the fancy terms and just kind of living. Is that... I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I completely agree. I'm going to just jump in here. I think it sounds to me from what the guests have been saying, it's about, you know, removing the rhetoric and talking about action. And I've even heard Chomsky say, you know, you don't apply capitalist values with inside the family structure, you know, and there's plenty of examples of people working together day to day. You know, I'm going to have to wrap up the show, and I want to thank all the callers for coming in, and I want to thank everybody for joining me, David Graeber, Evan, and Ramsey.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. And I want to thank engineer Maggie LaPique, myself, for Chris Burnett, and Alan Minsky, the producer.
You've been listening to Indie Media On Air, heard Mondays from 3 to 4 in the afternoon on Southern California's community radio station, KPFK 90.7 FM LA, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and at kpfk.org for the world. The Voices from the Frontline edition of the 4 o'clock report with Eric Mann is coming up next.